When it comes to raising capital these days, we're in a rather challenging, highly competitive time. The search for liquidity calls for creativity and, indeed, expansive thinking about strategies and tactics for following the money and finding new or emerging sources of funds. On this episode, we continue our 360-degree exploration of the REIT business, covering publicly traded REITs and non-traded REITs, or NTRs, and more. We've got the inside scoop on efficient capital sourcing in this multi-trillion dollar industry.
The channels are really starting to diversify, especially along with the evolution of product.
That's Brent Jenkins, a managing director and partner at Clarion Partners, a firm with upwards of $70 billion under management. Brent runs the firm's real estate income fund, which is commonly known by its ticker, CPREX, a five-year-old REIT that primarily sources capital through private wealth markets and currently holds net assets worth around $1.1 billion, a portfolio of private commercial real estate and publicly traded real estate securities.
You can't be insulated from everything, but on a daily basis, that's why private capital is often like a new horizon for some of these public REITs that are looking to expand.
And that's Zahir Syed, a senior managing director of CBRE Investment Banking. With capabilities worldwide, CBRE Investment Banking works with institutional and retail investors, focusing primarily on real estate, but also other real assets and infrastructure as well. Coming up, capital ideas for our time, where investors and fund managers are looking for liquidity and sourcing new forms of capital in the public and private markets. I'm Spencer Levy, and that's right now on The Weekly Take. Welcome to The Weekly Take, and this week we're going to talk about fund development and liquidity with a focus on non-traded REITs. Brent Jenkins of Clarion Partners. Brent, thank you for coming out.
Great to be on the show, Spencer.
And CBRE's Zahir Syed, second appearance on the show. Zahir, thanks for coming out.
Hey, Spencer. Always great to be on the show. Thanks for having me.
So, Brent, first a macro question of staying with the fund level, how's it going in terms of funds flows both in and out? Walk us through where the market was a couple of years ago and where is it today?
From a fund flow standpoint, it's been going very well for us. The industry as a whole, with higher interest rates, right, in real estate being a levered asset class, all funds within this space have not fared so well as we have necessarily in terms of positive flows. But those flows from a non-traded REIT industry standpoint have stabilized now, or I should say those redemptions that have been happening, which is a good thing. For us, we were very fortunate in that we've had pretty strong net inflows, CPREX that is, especially the last few years, which has been a great thing, you know, especially during a time of market dislocation. CPREX in particular has the ability to invest in both debt as well as equity. So in a higher interest rate environment, we have been able to pivot over to where we saw better risk-adjusted returns, right, on the debt side of the equation. And we had the ability to do it because of the net inflows. Today, right, we've seen now a general repricing of real estate itself. The risk-adjusted return spectrum has started to shift back over to equity. So from a fund standpoint and allocation, right, we've been doing more deals buying buildings rather than acting as a lender.
So, Brent, let me just ask you straight up, what are you buying?
You know, as a firm, we're a thematic-based investor. We are typically, with our strategies, investing for the long term. We utilize long-term global themes like demographics, what's going on with trade, what's going on with manufacturing. And we utilize those global themes to help drive us two different ways. One is to inform us for the long term which real estate sectors may look more attractive than others. And then the second way is from a geographic standpoint, which areas, say, if you're investing in the US, which regions or MSAs might benefit more than others from those global themes. So you're kind of putting yourself in front of the bus. And of course, right, there's still the ground up, I'll call it bottoms up analysis, or in terms of supply demand, you know, to try to project rent growth, because when you're making an investment, you want to make a good buy, you know, regardless of where long-term themes might drive you. But we're investing in what we call alternative investments, right, within real estate, things like, you know, student housing, senior housing, industrial outdoor storage. You know, we find those areas certainly attractive and a great opportunity. But then we're also continuing to invest in some of Clarion's real core areas, which historically have been industrial warehouse and all the different variations of it, along with rental housing strategies that would include multifamily.
Zahir, I think it's fair to say that fundraising for core has been tough over the last 18, 24 months, maybe longer, generally. But is this a bright spot? Is this, because this is an area that's not tapping into the traditional JV investor. This is tapping into the non-accredited investor, the retail investor. And if that is in fact the case, do you think that's a direction core funds might go?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely a possibility, but there is a big distinction on first mover advantage. So being able to get to that private wealth platform before another group does, say if you're a multifamily fund, right, or you're an industrial fund, there is a lot of work that goes into getting onto one of those private wealth platforms. And Brent will tell you, you got to fly around the country. You know, Quad City, Iowa was the one I mentioned to him before. It's like, and you got to talk to all the brokers and all the advisors and really get them on board. And that's an education. That's an educational exercise for everyone that's involved. And then there's two things that works in fundraising that is critically important right now. One is relevancy. Like, how do you stay relevant with a crowded field? And then two is, how do you maintain alignment? How do you create alignment so an investor has the incentive to continue to do the work? And I bring that back to your question, because the idea that everyone wants to access the private wealth, that's true. That's 100% true. I mean, everyone wants to get to defined contribution. Like, let's be honest, all of this is a staging exercise to get to where that defined contribution capital is going to end up. If you can have your manager be a part of a target date fund for the next 40 years, you know, that's, you talk about sticky capital, that's sticky capital, right? And that's fee retention, that's AUM growth, and that's enterprise value. All shareholders will be supportive of that. But I think the first mover advantage and kind of getting it right, I think the problems with NTR 1.0, we learned those lessons, you know, 10 years later, and now we're iterating into NTR 3.0. And the better we get at this, and the better we can educate our investors as a manager or as a banker, it really pays dividends forward, not actually, but, you know, the dividends and actually being able to create that trust with the retail investor. And that's something I think was probably missed 20 years ago, the value behind that. But we're continuing to iterate and create better products. And then the core funds could see this potentially as an avenue. But again, it has to be iterative in their approach to get that product right for that retail investor, whether that's today or 10 years down the road.
Yeah, and I'd like to add to that. I mean, it is a very high barrier to entry business, and it takes a lot of resource to really be successful and distribute a product. I call it a B2B2C type of marketing campaign that you need to do. You're out there distributing through registered investment advisors, I'll just call them in general, right, to the end user or the end investor in private wealth, who is the individual investor. I think these products are really important for the individual investor because they allow the individual investor to mimic what the big institutions do in terms of getting the benefit of just better overall returns, risk-adjusted returns out of their portfolios. So they're able to add allocations, right, just like the big institutional investors do to the portfolios of these alternatives, including real estate, to provide diversification, you know, income, inflation protection. I think that's all great. However, you know, getting to those investors is a difficult task. And on our product with CP Rex, we utilize the distribution team of Franklin Templeton to distribute it out to the market. Clarion, not sure that, you know, everyone is necessarily aware, but we are a Franklin Templeton affiliate. And so CP Rex is an opportunity, right, for the two firms to be able to really leverage the best of each other. Clarion as a real estate investor and Franklin as a large financial institution with a big distribution network to get out into the market.
My producers just hit me with 100 little definitional things. So let's just do this very simply so we can just get them into the air. In very basic terms, so our listeners understand, please describe the distinction between a non-traded REIT and a traded REIT?
A traded REIT is just what it implies. It is a fund that raises, or a company that raises money through private wealth via stock sales, but it is traded on an exchange. A non-traded REIT also raises capital from individual investors. It raises it through private wealth channels, and it does that through sales of stock, shares of stock. However, it is not traded on an exchange. So from a valuation standpoint, a public REIT is valued via its value at any given time per share on the stock market versus a private REIT. Its value is derived directly from its underlying assets. So from an investor standpoint, an investment in a public REIT is an investment in a company that invests in real estate versus somebody investing in a private REIT or like vehicle is investing effectively directly into private real estate assets through that vehicle.
And just a distinction, I know that in certain countries like Mexico, all of the REITs are externally managed, while in the U.S., all publicly traded REITs are internally managed. Are these REITs internally or externally managed?
They can be either, actually, but typically they are internally managed, typically managed by the sponsoring firm.
Define the differences between GPs and LPs.
So GP is a general partner, LP is a limited partner. In a fund structure, or even a JV structure, pretty much in any investment, the GP is the one that's managing the asset or the investment. And the LP is the retail investor, the public pension plan that's investing as a passive LP, a limited partner.
Well, I think this one's simple. Define contribution versus defined benefit. Please define that, Brent.
Defined benefit plan would be like a pension plan. The actual benefits that the retiree is going to see out of it are defined day one versus defined contribution plan is like a 401k.
The major motivation behind the growth of this $80, $90, $100 billion segment of the real estate market is this shift towards private money. You call it retail money. Some of it's accredited investors. And for people, the definition of accredited investor is typically a larger, small investor. And then there is non-accredited, including but not limited to 401k money, which I know the administration has talked about allowing that type of money to go into private equity funds too. So Brent, one of the key questions, and let's get right to it, is that when you're starting to tap 401k money in particular, there are special issues as it relates to things such as liquidity and other protections for these types of investors. I know you've talked about it. I know you're thinking about it. Why don't you tell us about it?
There are multiple layers of liquidity with respect to non-traded REITs and tender offer and interval fund, you know, structures operating in this space. First of all, the first line of defense, obviously there's lines of credit at the fund level that these funds have. The 40 Act limits the amount of leverage that can be drawn on those fund level lines of credit. The second is within the portfolios themselves, that the investment portfolios of these vehicles. So as I said, CPREX has the ability to invest in equity, buying buildings, debt, making loans. That's about 80% of the fund. The other 20% of the fund is a liquidity sleeve that is invested in our case in public debt securities, so CMBS and RMBS, and exists in order to really service the tender offer, because on a quarterly basis, these funds typically will offer up 5% of their NAV as liquidity to investors who want to redeem shares. Now, the second piece of this is in that DC space, right? Because in the DC space, those products need daily liquidity both in and out. In our case, CPREX, to the extent that we're operating in the DC space, and this would go for anyone else, would require an additional wrapper to go around them to provide additional liquidity. So CPREX looks a little bit different in the DC space. It's a different product. The underlying security in there may be CPREX with the liquidity attributes that I talked about. But in addition to that, there's an additional liquidity sleeve that's necessary to provide the additional liquidity needed for the product in that space. So as I said, there are multiple layers. Within just the non-traded space, you'll recall that those layers have been tested over the last few years with higher amount of redemptions. The good news is, in the way that the non-traded space is set up, that structure proved itself out over that period of time to be a structure that works, you know, when liquidity is needed.
Zahir, you're out in the capital markets every day raising structures of all different types. Tell us from your perspective how you go through these different options when you're speaking to a Clarion about what they should do.
Yeah, a lot of it comes down to what's the objective for the GP or the manager or Clarion in this instance? Like, where are you trying to get to today? And where, how does that match up with what you're trying to get to in 5 to 10 years? The reason we think about the short-term and long-term horizon is really trying to get the objective as to what's the vehicle structure that's going to match the cost of capital that's available in market today. And, you know, given the challenges we've had over the last 3 years in the capital markets environment, broadly speaking, not for all asset classes, being aligned with investors and coming up with a structure that provides the best alignment expedite some of that capital raising process. None of this is quick. It all takes time, but being able to come to an investor with something that has a little bit more alignment and a little bit more relevance really incentivizes them to dig deeper. So when we're looking at direct opportunities that maybe necessitate a JV type structure, or we're looking at commingled fund type opportunities that, you know, obviously will entail a structure that's a lot more traditional in nature. And then the open-ended versus closed-ended, I mean, those are different objectives that will either match up with what the GP is trying to do, meaning they're looking for something longer dated, sticky capital, or the investor may have a predilection to want something that allows for liquidity, which an open-ended structure or an evergreen structure can provide versus a closed-ended fund. So really trying to triangulate all those needs between the GP, the client, the investor, and how we can best advise on where we're seeing things move is really the job that we all play together.
So I think you may have done it subtly there by saying evergreen about the open-ended, but just in very basic terms, describe the difference between an open-ended and a closed-end vehicle and why you might recommend one or the other for a client.
Yeah, absolutely. So closed-ended, typical fund life is, you know, like 10 years. So you have a 3 to 4 year investment period where you're giving the investors giving their capital, committing their capital to a manager of a fund. Within 3 to 4 years, they deploy all that capital. Then there's the harvest period. And then there's dispositions that happen, you know, towards the 7 to 10 years of that fund life cycle. That's all closed-ended and closed-ended in nature, meaning that there's no way to get out of it unless you facilitate a secondaries transaction, which isn't a normal course of business for a closed-ended fund. There's always exceptions to a rule. But on the open-ended side, it's built with the capabilities to provide liquidity. There's a redemption queue, the valuations that are being conducted on a quarterly or monthly or sometimes even more frequent basis that provides transparency as to what that pricing actually is. And that's the fundamental nature that makes open-ended funds a little bit different than closed-ended funds. And also the assets that kind of go into that. That's a longer conversation, but we can really break out why certain structures on a closed-ended side make sense versus assets that would be held in an open-ended structure.
So, Brent, without going to every vehicle that Clarion has, let's just talk about your vehicle. Why this vehicle, and compare and contrast it to the others, why your vehicle might be attracted to some investors more than some of the others.
Sure. Clarion has a pretty long history. It goes back over 40 years. And through most of those 40 years, the firm has invested on behalf of institutional investors, primarily through core plus strategies. A number of those strategies are large open-ended funds. Over the last 10 years, especially, right, there have been a whole slew of new products out there, investment products like non-traded REITs, tender offer funds, interval funds that really work well with real estate. And is a growing, private wealth certainly is a, given that, is a growing sector of the market. And so Clarion, starting in the late 2010s, started to pivot over to really open up its platform to those individual investors through a couple of different strategies, one of those strategies being CP RECs. And at the time, you know, for individual investors, they had a couple of different options to be able to invest in real estate. One, of course, owning real estate yourself. But in terms of the markets, they could have accessed the markets through public REITs. Public REITs offer up a lot of liquidity. However, a public REIT is an investment in a company. And in addition to that, tend to exhibit a lot of volatility and trade a lot like small cap stocks. The other option that investors had at the time was to invest possibly through an interval fund, like a fund of funds interval fund. You know, however, you know, there's issues there, like double fees, because really it's a fund that invests in other funds. And so what we decided to do was try to offer up something that was a little bit different and ended up structuring ourselves as a 40 Act tender offer fund that gave investors the ability to invest directly in real estate without double fees and without, you know, some of the downsides of the non-traded REIT structure.
So Zahir, you've been in the capital markets for a long time. I used to cover the non-traded space years and years ago, but there's been a big evolution. In your opinion, what's changed?
If you take a step back, the broader backdrop of real estate private investing in a fund structure has evolved quite dramatically over the last 25 years. There's been, you know, an evolution of folks that have evolved from buying assets to buying companies to doing large take private transactions. We're talking about a series of the mega funds that are out there that are, you know, operating $20, $30 billion funds. And then there's the middle market, which has gone from being, you know, $200 to $400 million funds to $1 billion to $5 billion funds, which, you know, that was not the middle market. That was the bulge bracket, you know, 15, 20 years ago. All that evolution has really given people a moment to kind of reevaluate where they think the next tranche of capital availability will be for them. So if you think about the early stages of the institutional management, investment management business, it was all driven by defined benefit plans, effectively, right? Large state pension plans were really like driving that growth over the first 10 years of that business, if not longer. It still persists. It's still a big source of capital, but that evolution continues to persist because the last 10 years, and Brett and I were talking about it, has seen about 20% growth of retail capital on a compound annual growth basis. Retail capital into these alternative institutions, investment management institutions, and that's across asset classes. So going back to your question, what has changed? I think the GPs, the managers, the fund managers have pivoted their business to allow for retail capital to be a growth engine for the future. And that's A, forcing them to provide more transparency with the underlying investor. Because I think what happened with NTR 1.0, there was a little bit of fee load that, you know, drove a lot of the erosion of value, I would probably say. Whereas in NTR 2.0, where we are today, you know, it's about providing a lot more transparency to the investors. So they will understand. And you have to work with the private wealth platforms. We can talk about the operation that goes into this. And it has to be a lot more transparency now versus years ago. And that's allowed investors to have a willingness to continue to invest in this new asset class, because it is a new asset class for that group.
I agree with everything that Zahir said in terms of 1.0 and 2.0. And I would even go so far as to say now we're into 3.0 in terms of the non-traded REIT structure, with the advent of tender offer, 40 Act tender offer funds, as well as interval funds. So for example, the 40 Act actually requires additional transparency, for example, beyond what is currently offered by non-traded REITs in areas like leverage. So a 40 Act fund is only able to take on 33% leverage at the fund level, right? Fund level leverage, which matches up, you know, pretty well, if you think about it, to the strategy of a non-traded REIT tender offer fund or interval fund in terms of the type of real estate investment that it's doing, which is typically focused more on core and core plus properties, which are conservative strategies in themselves.
So I keep backing up and say, I need to simplify this just a touch for our listeners, okay? So let's assume I'm a individual that wants to put some money into a vehicle, okay? I call up my stockbroker, say, find me a fund. And you just mentioned, I think, two or three different types of vehicles. You mentioned a tender offer fund, an interval fund, and then the terminology that I've always used is just a non-traded REIT. Are those three separate vehicles, or just explain the distinction between those three vehicles?
The interval fund structure and the tender offer fund structure are very similar. They are structures that are governed by the 40 Act and therefore actually carry additional investor protections in areas like transparency. However, from an operational standpoint, and from an investor standpoint on the day-to-day basis, they operate pretty similarly to non-traded REITs in that to the extent that they have a ticker, right, they can offer up fairly frequent subscriptions so people can buy in our case, can buy in on a daily basis and do offer up a degree of liquidity to their investors. That's why a lot of times you'll hear that whole grouping of non-traded REIT, tender offer fund, and interval fund termed semi-liquid vehicles, because on a quarterly basis, and sometimes by quarterly, it could be in monthly increments, or it could be once per quarter, those vehicles offer up usually around 5% of their net asset value to buy back an offer to buy back stock. A tender offer fund does it through what's called a tender offer process, right? It's called something slightly different with interval funds and with non-traded REITs. But that structure exists in there so that even though investors view investments through these vehicles as a long-term investment, private wealth investors, a lot of times they're doing rebalancing of their portfolios over time, or there's a major life event that happens that causes them to need liquidity. And so they're able to use that similar structure between the three, you know, to get the liquidity that they need.
And the liquidity you're saying is about 5% per quarter is what your vehicle offers, ballpark?
5%. Yeah. That's pretty typical in the space.
I wouldn't be surprised if the whole publicly traded REIT space is smaller than one of the big tech companies today. So real estate is still a relatively small industry. Is that a fair way to put it, Zahir?
Yeah, I mean, it's if you look at how much capital has been raised in private equity and infrastructure and venture, it's still relatively small on a gross capital basis. I think one of the things that's really interesting when you talk about public REITs and, you know, the size and scale there is the reason why a lot of groups turn towards private capital is because A, there's a stickiness that comes alongside with it, which is really beneficial for any manager, but also that lack of volatility that you have in the public markets. You're really relatively insulated from that if you're raising a private capital vehicle to a certain extent. Obviously, you know, you can't be insulated from everything, but on a daily basis, that's why private capital is often like a new horizon for some of these public REITs that are looking to expand into either start a new strategy, incubate a new strategy, or have access to diversified capital that's outside of the public shareholders.
As you look out over the next couple of years, how big is this segment of the market going to be? And how far are we going to go to tap into 401k money, non-accredited investors, the broker-dealer network? And how big of a part is the non-traded REIT space going to be to capture some of that capital?
I think it's going to be a major piece. Zahir mentioned the growth rate of the alternatives, you know, private alternative space, which over the last 5 years, it's been growing at about a 20% CAGR. Real estate as a piece of, as a one sector within alternatives has been growing at about a 10% CAGR clip over that same time period. So there's quite a bit of growth in those channels. And those channels are continuing, as you said, to diversify. Right now, today, I call them the traditional channels within the US through which the distribution of non-traded REITs happen would be RIAs, so independent registered investment advisors, to independent broker dealers, slightly larger firms, generally speaking, and then wirehouses, which are really the big boys. Those are the traditional channels. But as you mentioned, you know, the channels are really starting to diversify, especially along with the evolution of product. So the DC channel, right, has been in the overall retirement channel is another source. DC channels, it's about a $12 to $14 trillion market that's barely been really penetrated by non-traded REITs. There are some structural issues with that market that had to be overcome in order to offer these types of products up through those channels. We as an industry, you know, have solved that. One of the big hurdles is daily liquidity. They need to look like, if you think about the types of products in the DC market, right, you have, you know, ETFs, you've got mutual funds. And, you know, what's common about those is that they're producing a daily value, right? And there's daily liquidity associated with them. So not only can people buy in, right, to those products on a daily basis, they also have the ability to trade out of them on a daily basis. So the products that are being developed to include real estate in the DC channel include additional liquidity. That best description kind of wrapped around, right, a product like a CP Rex or a non-traded REIT to create that additional liquidity to make them function like existing products in those channels. And so where we're seeing a lot of the evolution is in development of that. And we're starting now to see penetration, right, of real estate into DC.
As I hear from a capital markets perspective, from the perspective of the person people come to say, I need to raise money over the next couple of years, what do you see big picture and where do non-traded REITs play into that?
I'll take the first question on big picture. And I think that, listen, I feel better now than I had in several years. I think every year everyone's like, you know what? It's next year. I think the conversations I've had with large investors over the last several months have been pretty, I don't want to say promising, but they've been constructive. I'll give an example. I was talking to a large pension plan and, you know, they talked about, you know, their allocation to real estate. They were going to cut it from X percent to Y percent and they were cutting it. And as a placement agent, you know, that's like a knife to the heart. It's like, that's the capital that would go to one of my GPs that would ultimately pay me. But on hearing the science behind it and the rationale behind it, because of the public markets rally, because of, you know, not being able to allocate to real estate for effectively 2.5 years, right? That investors' allocation to real estate was completely deteriorated in general. It went down from, you know, 6% to like 4%. So for them to get to their target of, you know, some high number, it's paralysis. Being able to make decisions to fill that gap it's really tough because you have a long way to go. Shortening that allocation actually opens up the chamber so you can, you know, not be paralyzed anymore because you have a smaller target to kind of get to. And it became a lot more positive in my view when I heard that feedback, because it's like, all right, now you kind of know how much money you have to work with over the next 18 months. So you can be more strategic about where you want to place that capital. If it's a crazy amount of money you got to put to work in the next year, it's really tough to make decisions. I use that anecdote as an example of some robustness for real estate finally coming up again. I mean, that it has to do with, you know, the market settling a little bit, it has to do with interest rates coming down a little bit. But at the end of the day, capital markets hasn't allocated to real estate in scale for the past 3 years. So that void is going to be hopefully helpful for the new managers that are in market next year trying to raise capital for their funds. I think you juxtapose that with, you know, the other large sources of capital for commingled funds, which is endowments and foundations. And endowments and foundations, just so everyone's clear, they invest typically as a private markets investor. They're not necessarily having a real estate person run that book and a private equity person run that book and, you know, natural resources. It really is private markets. So when rates were elevated, you could easily pivot to some other asset class within private markets. Now we're effectively under allocated to real estate, we see that as hopefully being another source of capital over the next cycle.
Well, on behalf of the Weekly Take, what a great conversation about fund development, liquidity, non-traded REITs and other similar vehicles, the past and the future. And we had Brent Jenkins, Managing Director, Clarion Partners. Brent, thanks for coming out.
Thank you.
And then we had our own Zaheer Syed, second time on the show. First time was a charm, but second time even better. Thanks for coming out, Zaheer.
Thanks, Spence. Thanks, Brett.
For more capital ideas, there's related content on our website at cbre.com/theweeklytake. We've done a series of episodes on the REIT industry, which can be found archived there on the site or on the podcast platform of your choice. We'll be back soon as we head into the holiday season and into the home stretch of 2025. Don't forget to subscribe so we can keep you informed about our programming. And we look forward to you tuning in as we cap off a great year and start looking ahead to a new season in 2026. For now, thanks for joining us. I'm Spencer Levy. Be smart, be safe, be well.